You're listening to All Things Considered on WNYC. I'm Jamie Floyd. 30 years ago this week, a gruesome and racially charged criminal case began to unfold in New York City. On the evening of April 19, 1989, a young white investment banker was brutally raped and beaten while jogging in the northern reaches of Central Park. She clung to life while the city reeled from the horrific nature of the attack. And local media began a campaign of salacious coverage, putting pressure on police to round up suspects.
Police have linked several alleged gang members to similar incidents, which occurred a few days earlier in neighborhoods near the northern end of the park. The youths called the attack wilding, random assaults on innocent people. One of the youths is reported to have said he did it for fun.
Five young black and Latino teenagers were charged and convicted in two separate trials in 1990. Antron McCray, Yusef Salam, Corey Wise, Kevin Richardson, and Raymond Santana, who came to be known as the Central Park Five, were sentenced to lengthy prison terms. More than 20 years later, they were all exonerated. Here with me to discuss the continued significance of this haunting case are Professors Paul Butler of Georgetown Law School and Linnell Hancock of Columbia Journalism School. Thank you both for being with us.
Hey, Jamie. Great to be with you.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Paul, first to you. Looking back at the case, how does it fit into the historic narrative in this country of criminalizing black and brown men?
Jamie, first I want to say their names one more time. Corey, Antron, Raymond, Yusef, and Kevin. We have this narrative throughout history of the most notorious crime being an African-American man who is charged with sexually assaulting a white woman that summons all these stereotypes about black men as violent thugs. We would like to think that that's something we left back in the old Jim Crow, but now we know in this era of the new Jim Crow, there are actually more young black men in the criminal legal system now than there were back in the early 1990s and even back during the 1920s. And so we haven't made the kind of progress that we hope to have made. And we can be sure that those five children were not the last people to be wrongfully accused, and that there are many more people like that sitting in prisons today.
It is telling that the victim in this case also didn't want to be known as what we might call a caricature, the Central Park jogger. She came out and said her name eventually, Trisha Miley. She eventually wrote a book telling her own story. Linnell, let me turn to you as an education reporter in New York in 1989. You witnessed firsthand the way in which the story caught fire in the local press. Describe the nature of the coverage in the context of the culture of the city at that time, especially in terms of race and class and crime.
Well, you have to remember, New York City at the time was unraveling. The crime rate, it was at an all-time high and it was climbing. So there was a real sense of incendiary fear of crime itself. And of course, that was racialized in a lot of ways. So the coverage itself was pretty much hysterical, I would describe it. The crime itself was horrifying and it punctured through the normative violent crime of the time. But even more horrifying was the next day when the police story came out that the perpetrators were a marauding group of black boys who were in the park, supposedly for kicks, menacing people, and at the end of the evening had committed this brutal gang rape. It seemed very unreal. So I expected when the crime reporters, who I admired, when they would bring their studied sense of skepticism to the fore, they would start puncturing through this sort of fog of racial coverage. But the opposite happened, and the headlines just kept coming.
To send a shout out to the African-American press, even during the original charges, the City Sun and other black newspapers, they said, wait a minute, there's not compelling evidence of guilt, and based on everything we know about American history, it's likely that these children are being falsely accused. In many sectors, these newspapers and other activists who believed in the innocence of these children were seen as kind of race-baiting black nationalists who just would use any excuse to cry racism.
Let's lay out some of the details of the police investigation. The suspects were ages 14 to 16, boys, really. They were questioned for hours overnight, out of the presence of their families, for the most part. Each admitted some version of taking part in the attack, inconsistent versions, in fact, and they all later recanted. So, Paul Butler, how common is it for people, especially young people, to confess to crimes they did not commit? And how and why does that happen?
Well, we know from the science that of people who have been wrongfully convicted, one out of four of those people confessed. They told a lie in order to get the police from stopping doing what the police were doing, which is usually applying enormous psychological, emotional coercion to make the person confess. And in many instances, unfortunately, it includes physical force. The tragedy, especially in this case, is that the confession was the only evidence of their guilt. There was no DNA from any of these five children on the survivor. And later we found out, when the person who committed the crime came forward, that the government knew that there was a DNA sample from someone who was not one of these young men that couldn't be identified.
As Paul suggests, the case took a dramatic turn in 2002 when another man, Matias Reyes, who was serving time as a serial rapist and for a murder, confessed to the attack on the woman. In this case, his DNA matched the sample collected from the victim's body and clothing. Linnell Hancock, how did the media react to getting the story so wrong? Was there a reckoning?
I wish I could say yes. I remember that moment in 2002 being just as horrifying as finding out about the initial crime and the initial theory on the part of the police. Everybody got it wrong. Everybody from the prosecutors, every mainstream newspaper. There was some private mea culpa. A lot of people very quietly saying, what did we do wrong? What if those boys had been white? What a horrifying thing to think that we would have covered it differently.
The Central Park Five sued. They settled with the city for $41 million, and a judge approved the settlement in 2014 based upon the wrongful conviction and the number of years they'd spent behind bars. After the settlement, the men and their supporters addressed reporters. Here's Kevin Richardson.
Y'all don't really understand what we went through. Y'all tried to dehumanize us as human beings. But we still here.
That's right.
We're strong. Right. Nobody gave us a chance for the people that believed in us. Mm-hmm. People called us animals, wolf pack. I have four sisters and a mother. I would never do anything to a woman. I was raised better than that.
That's right.
It still hurts me emotionally.
We invited you both here because we wanted to talk about what we've learned and what we have not learned, how far we've come and how far we still have to go since this horrific miscarriage of justice occurred and this terrible crime. Linnell Hancock, how about in media, in journalism? Where do we go from here?
I would like to say that a reckoning has happened and that there are practices that have changed and there have been incremental improvements, but one of the biggest things that needs to happen is an increased diversity in the newsroom for us to even begin to talk about this. And that dial has not moved very far at all. There's some slight improvements, but in terms of race and class, not so much, especially on the mastheads in editorial positions of influence. The other thing that I think is really important, and it's going to be difficult to implement, and that is that reporters need to be out in the neighborhoods that they cover. They should be in the communities, not just swooping in when there's a disaster. So they understand their schools, they understand their needs, their tenant organization meetings, everything. it's going to be difficult to implement, and that is the biggest crisis in journalism right now, is the gutting of local news and the gutting of metro desks in urban areas, but especially in towns and regions and rural areas, so that there is no coverage of the courts, of the state houses, of the schools, and there's no information coming to people about their hometowns.
Paul Butler, as a law professor, what do you say to your students if they say, Professor Butler, where do we go from here?
Jamie, I try to keep it real with my students. I'm thinking of a young man named Khalif Rauter, who was also accused by the NYPD of a crime that he didn't commit. He had to sit in a torture chamber called Rikers Island Correctional Facility for 2 years, often in solitary confinement. He came home, but the psychological torture is too much to bear, and young Mr. Browder ended up taking his own life. And so maybe we haven't learned much from this situation. At the same time, I have a bunch of young folks who want to use the power of the law to make things better. And I think when you look at these new movements like Black Lives Matter, we see young folks who are shining a light, who are talking about ways to guarantee equal justice under the law. And maybe that's limited kinds of reforms like better training for police or body cameras. And maybe it's more visionary, transformative solutions. Some of the activists talk about new ways of thinking about public safety. You know, a lot of times when folks call 911, it's for a mental health crisis or a relationship issue, that having people with a gun and the power to arrest makes things worse, not better. So what these young activists are imagining is a world where there are more responses to social problems other than locking folks up and throwing away the key.
Paul Butler is a professor of law at Georgetown Law School, and Linnell Hancock is a professor of journalism at Columbia. Thanks so much to you both.
My pleasure.
Thanks for doing this. It's really important.